BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we continue our week-long series on immigration by talking about how communities are responding as immigrants fear deportation and face heightened threats. San Francisco, like many cities across the country, is taking steps to prepare for an aggressive federal crackdown on immigration. Last Friday, local immigration lawyers and activists held a training on how to respond during an ICE raid. And then this morning, immigrant rights advocates are gathering at San Francisco City Hall to press the Budget and Finance Committee to fund legal defense for detained immigrants. Restaurants and businesses across the country are closing today for a day without immigrants strike from Austin to Washington, D.C. On Monday, a day without Latinos action drew thousands of people in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So today we're talking about how immigrants and activists are preparing, what kinds of actions are people taking, what is most effective. Today we're joined by three guests. Jonathan Blazer is Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU. Jonathan tracks developments in state and local measures concerning immigrants, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. And we're also joined by Auda Bagato, a writer based in Los Angeles. Auda's stories about immigration have been featured in publications including Mother Jones, Teen Vogue, and The Nation. And I hope you can read her stories, especially the one she wrote called Don't Just Grieve for Immigrants, Fight for Immigrants. Auda Bagato joins us from NPR Studios in Culver City. Hi, Auda. Welcome to the show.
Rose, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Maru Vailpando, a community organization organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. That's an organization that focuses on racial justice and immigrant rights. And Maru joins us on the line from Washington. Hi, Maru. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. Maru, I want to start off with you. You're in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is getting a lot of attention because so many restaurants and businesses are closing for today's action, a day without immigrants. Talk about what you're seeing out there. What are you hearing? How successful has this day been so far?
Well, I'm in the other Washington. I'm in Washington State.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, people always confuse that. But no, we're in the Seattle-Tacoma area, the metropolitan area, and we actually are right now getting reports of businesses not opening their doors and a lot of people staying home. So we didn't expect that response people working, but employers. We also received just a couple of reports from the eastern side of the mountains, which is mainly a rural area, and a lot of Mexican restaurants in the Tri-City area, which is Pasco, Kennewick, and Richland, have also closed for the day.
And Auda, you're in Los Angeles. What are you hearing down there?
It's the same thing here. On my drive over to the studio this morning, I sort of tried to drive slowly and see if any spots were closed. And, you know, I didn't go in and inquire, but it does look like there's sort of less activity in certain parts of L.A.
And what are your thoughts about these actions a day without immigrants? On Monday, we saw thousands of people take to the streets in Milwaukee. How effective do you think these actions are?
Well, before we get to the effect part, you know, I think that it's important to listen to and pay attention to any immigrant-led sort of actions, particularly undocumented immigrant-led actions. But I do wonder about this focus on, you know, what immigrants can provide versus who immigrants are as human beings. And so I do kind of wonder about that. We get a lot of stories about, you know, the more sympathetic immigrants, the immigrants who are not working and therefore not providing, you know, certain labor that is valuable to people or certain commodities, right? In terms of the effect, I do think that it can have a positive effect. I think that it can make people think about what would it actually be like if there were less immigrants here. But, you know, I do wonder about maybe some of the negative effects. I also don't know that it necessarily creates more sympathy on the part of people who already don't like immigrants to begin with.
Mm. Well, we'll talk about that in a couple minutes. But Maru, what would you add? How effective do you think these actions are?
Well, it depends of the region. It depends who's organizing it. A lot of the people that contacted us, they just happened to see a meme on social media. Mm. And we wonder, okay, who's actually putting this together and what is the messaging? So what we invited people to do is just to report if they were trying or were thinking of were actually organizing these kind of activities, and that we will follow up with support from contacting them with media. We didn't want to see them as organizers because, first of all, we're not the organizers of such action, but also we are afraid that some people might get fired because of not going to work, which has happened in the past when people have joined marches, and we don't want to be responsible for such a response or retaliation. And we don't have the capacity to actually follow up with people that might get fired. So we think that it's great that people want to do this. I think that today is kind of a combination of being afraid of ICE activity in the past 2 weeks throughout the nation, but it's also, I think, it's a way people feel that they can respond to these attacks against our communities.
Jonathan, what are your thoughts about how people are responding? We're seeing protests. There's lawyers and activists are holding trainings on how to respond. As I said, this morning, immigrant rights activists are on the steps of City Hall pressing the Budget and Finance Committee to fund legal defense for detained immigrants. What are your thoughts about just what we're seeing in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, well, with respect to today's actions, we weren't at the ACLU centrally involved in organizing those, and I would just defer comment and all due respect to people who are. I think the other guests have noted the strategic and safety considerations that go into deciding what types of actions to organize, and I hope today's actions go well and are successful in highlighting important issues about contributions, even though contributions are only a very small piece of the puzzle, as Aura mentions. I have to note with certainty, however, we've been working to fight the Muslim and refugee bans imposed by Trump's unconstitutional executive order over the past few weeks. And there is absolutely no question in my mind that people showing up at the airports the way they did, in the numbers that they did, with the discipline that they did to focus upon message and have peaceful protests, had an incredible impact. The courts who are hearing these cases live in the same world that we do. They see that this is going around us. The Democrats in Congress, who we need to hold the line against Trump's agenda, see that that it emboldens them to take strong actions when we see that kind of activity. And I do not believe we would have gotten the court decisions that we would have gotten had not people shown up immediately at the airports and demand that individuals be released. So the resistance makes a difference. And it's not just on these national issues. People here in the Bay Area have been showing up and demanding that localities in San Francisco and Richmond and Berkeley in Emeryville and Oakland reaffirm their sanctuary policies, strengthen and broaden those sanctuary policies, and send a message to Trump that they are not going to buckle under his threat.
And those protests got 24/7 cable coverage. People were reporters were there. They interviewed people protesting. They interviewed lawyers. Given the resistance that we're seeing on the streets, and so many people are now wanting to get involved. I mean, every time we do a show about what's most effective on the streets, we get calls from people who've never been involved before and want to do something. What would you say is the best way to resist locally?
Well, I do think local policies that answer the question of whether or not police and local governments are going to be part of the deportation machine or are going to leave that dirty work to ICE are the clearest expression of a locality's public policy right in this moment. So these efforts to really look and examine at the various ways in which local governments use their resources or choose not to use their resources to assist in the deportation business Some people call these sanctuary policies. Some people call them equal policing policies or Fourth Amendment policies. It's kind of a very clear movement right now, an expression of where a locality stands. Trump can't deport them all without the cooperation and enlistment of local police agencies. And California and other states and its localities have a choice to make as to whether it wants to play ball in that regard or whether it wants to stay out of it.
What is the best way to find out what is actually happening in communities? Because of social media, there are sometimes warnings about checkpoints, and then people say, no, that actually didn't take place. There's a lot of fear, obviously, and confusion out there. So what is the best way when you see something posted saying, stay away from this intersection because there's a checkpoint there? What's the best way to get the right information?
I think it's very challenging. I'd be interested in hearing what Maru and Ara have to say in that regard. I mean, we do love United We Dream. They're a great organization. They have a website in which people can check for information and actions, and they're also asking people to text 877-877 to be part of a rapid response network, and I'm sure that UWD will do everything it can to post accurate information. But the truth is, whether it's posted by UWD or the ACLU or any of the other groups out there, we're only acting on the information that's provided. And sometimes it can be very difficult for community members to understand what's happening at a traffic stop, which agencies are involved, whether it's an ICE enforcement action or a police enforcement action. And it confuses things significantly that ICE continues to wear flak jackets and uniforms that say first police, and then under that in smaller letters, ICE. You can understand the source of confusion about who's involved.
And before I ask Aura and Maru about that, I wanted to ask you, Jonathan, just in terms of what we can expect, these crackdowns have happened over the last week. Do you have the official numbers? I've seen 650. One of the guests yesterday said it could have been up to 3,500, the number of people arrested and deported.
I don't think that we know the whole answer to that. What we do know is that ICE has acknowledged, and through a press release a couple of days ago, undertaking stepped-up enforcement activities, which most people called raids, in the community in four different cities. We know from reports elsewhere that those were not the exclusive areas of operation of ICE, so they chose to disclose, you know, and highlight with video footage as if they're proud and want the public to see people being taken into custody and detained. Actions in four different cities. The ones that they highlighted were Chicago, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and they said the San Antonio Field Office of ICE, which I think was referring to raids in Austin, Texas. And so we know what they've said about those operations, but we've had reports in many other parts of the country. And, of course, that's nothing new in a sense. I mean, ICE enforcement activity around the country every day has been a phenomenon that's been with us for decades. It gets to be very difficult then to distinguish and pinpoint which of these things look like something different in tactic, approach, and legality from what we've seen in the past. And we are starting to see some evidence that ICE is pushing the envelope as far as it thinks it can get away with legally, and it's going to be up to all of us to stop them.
And do you expect these raids to continue?
I think that there will be resistance to them, and the best resistance is the local community kicking up dirt each and every time they happen and objecting so that they happen fewer and far between rather than as a regular course. But yes, Donald Trump ran on an agenda at one point of deporting them all. He then claimed to have scaled that back to focusing, quote-unquote, only on immediately deporting 3 million, quote-unquote, criminal aliens. So this is his agenda, and ICE embraces it. And what we're finding from this early set of raids that ICE revealed information about, they just sent a letter to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and the numbers are ugly in terms of laying bare that what they call criminal aliens, what Donald Trump would like the public to believe are the bad hombres that he's going after. A majority of them appear to be people with very low-level infractions, many of them traffic violations or status-related offenses. So it is true that it is a crime to re-enter this country after having been deported. It is true that it is a crime to enter the United States without inspection. But that's not the criminal aliens that Trump would have you believe that he is going after and who pose a threat to public safety.
Didn't that become a crime under the Obama administration?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. The Nation had a piece about that. We've been talking about
it. Became
it
became much more highly prosecuted
right.
as a crime that had been on the books for a while and largely unprosecuted.
Jonathan Blaser is Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU, where he tracks developments in state and local measures concerning immigrants. Aura Bogado is a writer based in Los Angeles. You can find her stories about resistance at yourcallradio.org. And Maru Vialpando is a community organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. And today we're continuing our week-long series on immigration by talking about how immigrants and communities are responding. Today is a day without immigrants. Businesses and restaurants are shutting down across the country. There's also various legal defense funds that are being put together to help detained immigrants. Local immigration lawyers and activists are holding trainings on how to respond during ICE raids. What are your thoughts on this? What's happening in your community? What do you think is most effective when it comes to being an ally and organizing on the ground? If you have any personal stories, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Aura, why don't you jump in and talk about the resistance that you have been reporting on, and just based on the activists that you've interviewed, what is most effective at this point?
That's probably a better question for Maura. I actually just interviewed her, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, and I was posing this question to her because a lot of people are asking it of me. I do want to go back to this, the question that you asked earlier of Jonathan in terms of checkpoints. You know, it is impossible to know where they are. A checkpoint can open up and shut down. A lot of times it can be just a regular police checkpoint. And again, those come and go. The videos that were released of the apprehensions, you know, one of them, I recognized the area right away. It's right here in L.A. It's in Whittier. And one person is being apprehended from a car, and there are a lot of agents, a lot of government vehicles that are involved. And someone emerges, one of the agents emerges with an AR-15. So he has a semi-automatic weapon aimed ostensibly toward the person who's being apprehended, but also toward like oncoming traffic, you know, on a public street. So I think that while it may not be the best course to post anything that you might see and maybe not fully comprehend about what's happening on social media, and that does spread fear in and of itself, I do think that there's another way in which people are you know, legitimately or justifiably are living in fear. I think that within immigrant communities, there is a lot of that justifiably happening, because even on the videos that we do see, we see these sort of like, you know, heavy weapons being used just to apprehend one person who's not even, you know, putting up any kind of fight at all, any kind of physical fight at all. Mm-hmm. And then going back to this issue of checkpoints in particular, you know, to piggyback on some of what Jonathan was saying, when they are police checkpoints, we see that police time and time again are this sort of in-between, this go-between between undocumented immigrants or even documented immigrants, including green card holders, and ICE. We see the way that police criminalize, so that it is the practice on the part of law enforcement to turn common, everyday activities into illegal acts, and they're made sort of more illegal and therefore detainable and deportable when the person who's committing the act, whether it's like jaywalking or whether it's, you know, a small amount of marijuana, even in a state like California where it's legal, but federally it's still illegal. You know, I think that there is, it's important for people to know where police checkpoints are, because sometimes they don't want to come, oftentimes undocumented immigrants don't want to come in contact with police because an everyday activity that a U.S. citizen is committing is sort of acted upon very differently when it's an undocumented immigrant.
And Maru, what about what's happening in Washington? How are people getting the most accurate information there?
Well, it's hard. It's really hard to get accurate information. As I mentioned, it's a very well-based fear that we, as undocumented immigrants, have of interacting with the police. What we did last year, because let's remember, this is not new, right? This has been happening for a really long time. Just last year in January, there were also several raids happening in different states, such as Georgia, North Carolina, Texas. And based on the experience that we saw there with the sister organizations of the No One More Deportation campaign, we decided to have a toll-free number for people to report ICE activity, right? We want to monitor them as they monitor us. So we set up this toll-free number, the 1-800-357-3196. And that way we were able to filter information. So we were asking people that heard anything to ask the witness of that event to actually call us. And that way we were able to filter a lot of the information. Not everybody gets to call because even people are afraid of the toll-free number. But so far we haven't been able to confirm checkpoints in Washington. That doesn't mean it's not happening. I mean, the biggest population is dispersed throughout Washington in rural areas where even there's no signal for our phones. So it's hard to tell, you know, if this is actually happening or not. But for us, the most important thing is that when we have social media reports, we try to locate the source of that to confirm, because we don't want to be doing the job of ICE. ICE's job is to scare our people and to have us afraid. And that's the last thing we want. But that doesn't mean that we're not being realistic, that yes, this activity has been happening. It increased under Obama. And now there's free rein for ICE and Border Patrol under this new regime. And I always tell people, remember, ICE and CBP's union endorsed Trump. And so as he took office, obviously, these agents now feel they can go rogue even more so than they did under Obama. Mm.
Jonathan, you wanted to jump in?
No, thanks.
What about the, since we're talking about ICE, the Know Your Rights trainings that are taking place across the country? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly important. It's been that way for years, but right at this moment, especially, and it can also help to give something for people to do with their sense of panic and nervousness. It's very empowering for people to be engaged with immigrant communities or not immigrants, organizing Know Your Rights trainings, and for people to receive the information. In terms of the content of what is sort of most critical and relevant in the face of the stepped-up raids that we've been seeing, I wanted to emphasize three core basic constitutional rights that apply to all of us. People are often familiar with these rights in the criminal setting, but they also apply in the immigration and deportation setting. The first is the right to remain silent and not say anything. It's amazing how often the difference between ICE being able to deport an individual and having to let them go is what a person blurts out voluntarily. ICE bears the burden of demonstrating that an individual is foreign-born and is deportable. And very often, their case is able to proceed to a judge and to deportation because a person admits things that they have absolutely no obligation to admit. And U.S. citizens have also been deported in this manner by admitting that they were foreign-born and then being unable to prove that they are a naturalized U.S. citizen. So it's a right that protects all of us, not just undocumented immigrants. The second is the right to ask ICE for a warrant signed by a judge before consenting to ICE entering your house to arrest somebody or to search your house. And here's a dirty trick that ICE often tries to pull at a door, is that they'll slip a piece of paper under the door that says warrant on it, but it's just a piece of paper that ICE wrote. It's an administrative warrant from ICE and not something signed by a judge. So it's very important to ask for a warrant signed by a judge. Just like in the criminal setting, the government cannot enter your home and search your home without a judicial warrant. And then finally, the right to speak or meet with a lawyer, especially before you say anything or before you sign any papers. Now, here there's a little bit different than in the criminal setting. The government does not recognize its obligation to appoint you a free lawyer if you can't afford one in deportation proceedings. But you have the right to try and find one, to ask for one, to call your consulate to see if they can hook you up with one. And especially in the Bay Area here, there are a lot of legal organizations that provide free legal services or reduced legal services. And people should not be signing any papers and should not be speaking with federal immigration enforcement officials without first consulting with a lawyer.
Jonathan Blaser is Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU. Aura Bogado is a writer based in Los Angeles. And Maru Vallapando is a community organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. Today, we continue our series on immigration by talking about how communities are responding as immigrants fear deportation and face heightened threats and racism. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or a question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Help a San Francisco young person build a future by connecting them with the real world experience. Students from high schools across the city are looking for summer internships. Your company or organization can make a difference. To find out how, just go to KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will end our week-long series on immigration by talking about media coverage of the crackdowns, the fear of arrest and deportation. In some cases, I've been talking about this throughout the week, but it's leading to people taking very dangerous journeys seeking asylum in Canada in the freezing cold. So how are the media covering the plight of refugees and immigrants and why they risk everything to travel to the United States knowing they could be deported? That is on tomorrow's show. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how immigrants and communities are responding, and we'd love to hear from you. What are some ways you've been getting involved on immigration issues? Do you have questions about how to get involved or where to begin? How is your community responding? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you played a part or remember the creation of sanctuary cities back in the 80s in the Bay Area when federal policies were denying asylum for refugees fleeing violence in El Salvador and Guatemala, we'd love to hear your story. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Jonathan Blaser, Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU, Aura Bogado, a writer based in Los Angeles, and Maru Vallapando is a community organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. Let's spend some time talking about the power of storytelling. We've been doing shows all week. We've been hearing from undocumented immigrants, talking to them about why their families decided to come to the U.S. and what life has been like under Obama and under Trump. And Maru, I understand that you came to the United States. You fled Mexico City in 1992. Can you tell us why you made that decision to leave?
I was still in college, and I decided that I couldn't afford living in Mexico since the government had already set up the way for NAFTA, the Northern America Free Trade Agreement, to come into place. So I decided to very reluctantly come to the United States. I was here for a year trying to better my English skills, and then I decided to go back because I really didn't like it here in Seattle, Washington. Hmm. So I end up going back, and but then NAFTA came into full enactment, and also the same year that came into enactment, there was a presidential year, electoral presidential year, and the main party that always won every year for 70 years, the candidate got killed in the middle of the electoral campaign. And I've always liked being involved in my community and in politics. And so I decided to leave again because I figure if he gets killed, anybody gets killed. So it wasn't only about the fact that we were being uprooted by the trade agreements and by the policies of the United States throughout the world, including my country, but this time was also the fact that in my country, it had reached a level of danger for people trying to get involved in bettering the politics in our country. So that's why I decided to come back and stay. The other reason why I ended up staying, even if I wanted to go back, is that my daughter was born here in 1996. Clinton decided to make it impossible for us, for people without documents, to get an immigration status. But also that if we try to leave and attempt to come back, then we will be barred 10 years from being in the country. So I haven't been back in my country for 21 years now.
Wow. So you cannot go back?
No, because if I attempt to come back, I will be barred for 10 years. And I'd rather be here with my daughter than attempting to see my family back in Mexico.
Maru, you have been very, very active. And, you know, what are your thoughts about the power of telling stories? We had an undocumented UC Berkeley senior on the show earlier this week, Juan Prieto, and he said that his family left Mexico in 2001 because of NAFTA, and they were working in manufacturing plants, in a Tommy Hilfiger plant, being paid less than a dollar a day, which is obviously impossible to live on. And that's why his family left Mexico. I'm sure there are so many stories like that. But what are your thoughts just on the power of telling those kinds of stories?
Well, they're very educational. I think for the xenophobic anti-immigrant community here in the United States, it's very easy to blame us for coming here. But I think people need to understand the reasons why we are pushed to migrate in the first place. But also, I think it's important that it goes into a deeper analysis of European settlement here in the United States. I mean, when we go out and do our organizing grassroots work, we always find people that still claim, you know, but you came here without a permit, which is actually the vast majority of undocumented people came with a visa and overstayed their visa, like myself. But the point is, if we're going to talk about, you know, stories, as you're saying, maybe we should also go deeper to those that came into this continent and stole the native land, not only here in the United States, but throughout our continent. So obviously, stories are really powerful, are really important, because also we can go in ending this rhetoric of the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant, which is what happened here in Seattle just this week, right? When this young man was detained along with his father, and he's a DACA recipient. But what happens is that people want to hear the story of a good immigrant with DACA, and that he shouldn't have been placed in deportation proceedings. And hardly anybody talks about his dad. Hardly anybody talks about the 1,600 people that are detained right now in the detention center. And we have a lot of stories of each one of them, a lot of them people that served their time in prison, and now they're placed in deportation proceedings. So it is important for us to share those stories.
And you're talking about Daniel Ramirez Medina, who received a deferred action protection and was arrested and detained in Washington. He's a 23-year-old father of a toddler.
That's right. And there's a lot of young people right now in the detention center. We just met this woman from Guatemala. She's 19 years old. She crossed the border, and a lot of the people crossing the border right now turned themselves in, asking for asylum. And as she crossed the border here in the southern border with Mexico, she's transferred all the way to Washington State, almost Canada. She doesn't even know where she's at. And she's asking for asylum, and instead the government decides to place her in deportation proceedings and detain her in them. And that's important to know. The deportation proceedings shouldn't imply that people should be detained. And that's one thing we've been talking about for the longest time. I think those stories need to be told.
What about this case, Jonathan? A lot of people thought that DACA recipients would, quote, be safe. But the LA Times reports that 23-year-old Daniel Ramirez Medina was sleeping at his father's home near Seattle when agents arrived. They arrested his father, for whom they had an arrest warrant, according to the lawsuit. And after the arrest, according to the complaint, the agents asked Daniel, "Are you here legally?" And he said, "Yes, I have a work permit." On his brother's advice, he declined to answer further questions. And at that point, according to the complaint, agents took him to a processing center in Seattle, where he again informed authorities that he had a work permit. But one of the agents said, "It doesn't matter because you were not born in this country."
Yeah, I mean, I think this case is very concerning, and it's an important test for whether ICE will be allowed to run wild or play by the rules. I may be naive. I still want to believe that this will turn out to be portrayed at least as a local ICE error and reversed. But if it's not, it is extraordinarily concerning on two fronts. The first is on the deferred action for childhood arrivals, the DACA program front. The government made a promise to these individuals. People went through a complex application. They were fingerprinted. They paid a large fee to the government, and they received in return an employment authorization allowing them to live here and permission to remain during the duration of their status without fear of being put in deportation proceedings. So if this is not reversed, it feels like an enormous betrayal, and a betrayal that many people thought President Trump said he would not commit. So I think we'll see on that front. I have to say that beyond the DACA question, the case also really highlights another very concerning change in Trump's immigration policy. One of his executive orders that focused upon interior enforcement made clear, shockingly, that when he talks about prioritizing quote-unquote criminal aliens, he does not mean, which was bad enough under the Obama administration, people who are convicted of crimes, even if they've served their time and gone back to their communities. He means anybody who was arrested or charged for any crime, regardless of whether or not they were ever convicted. And most shockingly, for us at least, he also made very clear in that executive order that he also means anybody who ICE believes has committed a crime, whether or not they've ever been charged or arrested. And here's where we get this, what I think probably is phony garbage, but the fact that the executive order opens the door to it will allow ICE to claim it, the phony garbage that Daniel Ramirez Medina admitted under ICE interrogation to being affiliated with a gang, whatever that means. Even if he has never been arrested or charged, or have had any due process to try to refute those charges, ICE says that it extracts some acknowledgement or concession from him of some loose affiliation, and therefore he becomes a priority criminal alien target under this new Kafkaesque deportation regime that Trump established under this executive order.
And there are currently 742,000 Dreamers in the United States who have temporary protection from deportation and work permits.
Right.
So because of this story, last week they thought they would be safe, but because of this, now I'm sure a lot of people are frightened and uncertain about what's to come.
I think people are rightly nervous. I do want to point out that this is the one case that people are aware of so far out of the 742,000 individuals. So we're not seeing a trend here yet. I also want to point out, just as people are feeling nervous, that this individual was not a target of the enforcement action. He was present when somebody else was being targeted. I'm also concerned about his father and no less about his father's case. So it's not, I just want to be clear, we don't have evidence yet that Trump is targeting DACA individuals, but we do have clear indication so far that at least that local office thinks that they're up for grabs if they happen to find them in the field when they're undertaking other enforcement actions and can prioritize the removal even though they've been vetted and granted DACA status.
That is Jonathan Blazer, Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU. We're also joined today by Aura Bigotto, a writer based in Los Angeles. You can find her stories at yourcallradio.org, and Maru Vial Pando, a community organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. Today, we continue our week-long series on immigration by talking about how communities are responding as immigrants fear deportation and face heightened threats and racism. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Gail in Palo Alto. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi there. Yes, I would like to encourage your listeners to check in with their state senators and their state assembly persons and make sure that they will support three bills supported by the ACLU. One is in the Senate, two of them are in the state Senate. That's SB 54 and SB 6. And these would limit the cooperation of local law enforcement to enforcing actual judicial warrants. And the other two would help provide more access to legal representation. The third one of the three is in the state assembly. That's Assembly Bill Number 3. And I would also mention that it would be nice if ACLU would, if they don't already have a one-pager on the website that we can download and copy and hand out. That would be lovely.
Can you give your contact information to the producer after you get offline, and I'll follow up with you on that? We do have one-pagers on those bills, and I'll just say the bill numbers again and maybe throw in another.
Well,
go ahead.
I'm thinking of, I have that, but it's the advice. The three things to remember if they come to your door.
Oh, right. Know Your Rights. Is there a Know Your Rights page on your website?
Both the Northern California ACLU and the National ACLU at www.aclu.org has the information that I just presented on its website.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gail. What can you tell us just quickly about these bills?
So the bills are very important, and I really do think California has a unique opportunity to make sure our laws here and our state policies here reflect our core values of inclusion, fairness, and justice. And the first bill that the caller mentioned, the California Values Act, SB 54, builds on positive steps that California has taken in the past through the California Trust Act and the California Truth Act. But whereas those bills focused upon what happens inside the doors of jails and the ways in which ICE uses jails as their pipeline for deportation, the California Values Act takes a broader look at a variety of interactions between California state and local agencies and federal deportation agents, and stands for the principle that the deportation business is not California's business, it's the federal government's business, and it is detrimental to California when those lines are blurred and when states and localities use their own resources for the deportation process. It doesn't interfere with the federal government. California is not permitted by law to interfere, but it doesn't entangle California in the process.
And Democrats have a supermajority in Sacramento in the Assembly and the Senate. Have you been hearing what's the likelihood of these bills passing?
I think the bills are supported by that supermajority. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to predict what bills Jerry Brown signs and which bills he has concerns with. He looks carefully at things. I know he's hearing from a lot of people about why this bill is so important and why it would be an incredible statement at this moment for California to be at the cutting edge. I know he's very concerned with Trump's mass deportation agenda. And I think calls need to go in both to people's elected representatives in the legislature and to Governor Brown's office.
All right. Well, thank you again, Gail. And you can find more information about those bills at the ACLU Northern California website. Aura, I wanted to talk to you about the piece you wrote for The Nation, Don't Just Grieve for Immigrants, Fight for Immigrants. And you write about the most effective ways to be an ally. You write that, you know, how are the most vulnerable people in your life doing at this moment? It's time you make a phone call to find out. Now more than ever, all progressives, but particularly white progressives, need to make unequivocal declarations of solidarity with vulnerable communities. As protests spread in response to Trump's victory, Demonstrators need to remember that the stakes are different for people of color whose very bodies are targets. The stakes are especially different for undocumented immigrants, the people whom Trump turned into ridiculed objects of hate and won an election by doing so. The least white folks who care about social justice can do right now is check in with immigrants they personally know to make sure that we are surviving and to confirm that we are still alive. Can you elaborate on that, and what kind of response have you received to this piece?
Sure. So for context, I wrote that I think it was election night or very early the next morning. I had spent a lot of those hours fielding phone calls and texts from my own family members and friends. And a lot of people were really, I think a lot of progressives were really reeling from the election results. In some ways, hearing you read that, it sounds like almost another lifetime, because so much has happened from then until here, until today, rather. I think that some people thought that maybe, you know, it was a little strong to say that, because there really are so many concerns, so many concerns under Trump, not only immigration, but in other ways we've seen, I mean, we've spent the last hour talking about how heavily enforcement is getting out there into communities. This executive order in particular, you know, has targeted green card holders, even at airports, right? And so I think that a lot of the response also was then, and I've also had people, white progressives, kind of reach out to me since then and say, like, oh, you know, thank you for putting that out there, because sometimes we forget the people that are most vulnerable. And you know, I think that it's important, for example, to have information about knowing your rights, and whether you're documented or undocumented, you do have all of those rights. But I think that sometimes, and it's not, Jonathan has not done this at all on this program, but I've seen definitely on social media, sometimes white progressives get very smug and say, like, well, you'll be fine if you know your rights, don't worry about it. And I think that a lot of people, again, justifiably think and assume now that really they may not be fine. It is true that Daniel Ramirez is the only DACA recipient that we know of, and it's likely that he will, you know, that this is an error on the part of that particular ICE office in Washington. But people are rightfully scared, right? And so to, you know, sometimes take an attitude of like, well, if you know your rights, you'll be totally fine. That's not really, that hasn't ever been the case for people of color, you know, and even beyond the immigration issue. Someone like Sandra Bland, she knew her rights. She knew her rights, and we know that she knew her rights because she'd said as much on video, and she wound up dead. And so I think that rights, in theory, are definitely, you know, inalienable, but in practice, that's not always the case. And I think that it helps to check in with people. I know that I've had people, you know, I have a mixed status family, so I've had, you know, people check in with me, and I personally appreciate it. And it's, you know, it's good to be kept in mind in different ways by people that want to support at this really sort of stressful moment for a lot of immigrants and a lot of immigrant families.
Mm. And Maru, what would you add? What would you say is the most effective way to support immigrants and be an ally?
Well, definitely agree with what Ara just said. We, as soon as the elections happened, we had obviously different meetings with different communities. For one, we had meetings with allies, and we had meetings with our undocumented communities. We decided, based on what we hear from our undocumented communities, that what we wanted to do was to actually be able to create resistance, going beyond know your rights. Because what we see is this intention on the side of the government to deport us. The law is not on our side. The law has been used against us. So how can we actually resist, and so not survive, but resist and fight back during these next 4 years of this enforcement machine that was handed to this administration? So for one,
we are doing a resistance workshop where we teach people how both the immigration and the criminal system operate, how both of them work together to put us in deportation proceedings, and at what point we can actually interrupt either or both systems. We also teach people tools on how to be prepared for any emergency, including an immigration raid. But then we also teach them how to, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood, come together and fight back if any of us is taken by immigration. Because we know that knowing our rights is not going to guarantee that we're not going to be taken away. So if that happens, then we want our community to show up for each other, to block the streets if necessary. If that doesn't work and people are sent to the detention center, we're going to show up in numbers like we did for this young guy and his dad. And we've been out there every night. Like last night, we left around 11:30 at night, about maybe 20 people of the 50 that came in the rain and the cold. And also to create public pressure, because that's what we want. We want to make sure that people know that we're just not going to let it happen. Like, it's been happening for a really long time. And for our allies, we're asking more than just being allies. We're asking them to be our co-conspirators, to go beyond just trying to serve or help. We want them to find their right role that fits them, but understanding that this fight goes beyond undocumented immigrants, goes beyond documented immigrants. It's about people of color. Mm. It's not only about our communities, but it's also about Muslims and Black communities and Native communities, and how do we actually work together to end white supremacy.
Maru Vailpando is a community organizer and founder of Latino Advocacy. Jonathan Blazer is Advocacy and Policy Counsel for the ACLU, and Auda Bigado is a writer based in Los Angeles. You can find more information about their work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the recent ICE raids. The fear of arrest and deportation has led people to take dangerous journeys seeking asylum in Canada in the freezing cold. How are the media covering the plight of refugees and immigrants, and why they risk everything to travel to the United States knowing they could be deported? That's tomorrow. Next Tuesday, The Roxy is hosting a screening of Merchants of Doubt. It's a documentary about how climate deniers sell doubt about climate change. Following the film, I'll be on a panel about climate change reporting. The film starts at 7 o'clock. You can find more information at roxy.com, R-O-X-I-E. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.